Welcome back to the All Else Equal podcast. I'm a special guest, John Winston. Today I'm here with pointy-headed experts, Jason Reed and Forrest Benz.
I actually prefer the earlier title of lifeless and self-serving technocrat, but thanks, John.
At the very least, this book has given us amusing job titles. Today we're going to wrap up our discussion on Angronomics. The final dialogue is, in my opinion, the strongest of five, or at least the most interesting, with some caveats. The authors lay out their vision for how to channel nationalism into a driver of equitable economic growth.
So taking a step back to the end of the fourth dialogue, the authors are going to set this up on page 118. A little bit more than halfway down the page, they say, "We believe that we have serious problems, but there's no clear sense of, okay, here are the policies to go for based upon these new ideas," which reinforces the space for regressive tribal politics. The era of anodyne centrism has left us not only bereft of motivating political identities, but also it seems to be bereft of useful new ideas. What it is there are tend back to the national state, and perhaps there's a reason for that. Consider that every time the system has a crash and reset, every time something really disrupts the system, the container of hopes becomes the nation state for good or ill. And then they go on a bit. And then skipping on to page 119, about halfway down, all these perspectives appear at one level as cynical attempts to deflect attention away from a disconcerting, complex, and uncertain reality with a simplistic and comforting return to tribal flag waving. All that is wrong is global, cosmopolitan, or market-driven. If only we could revert back to the local, the national, the knowable, to the us of the nation. So my question is this: can we use the default setting of the nation to address the drivers of Angronomics without succumbing to the darker instincts of nationalism? And so that's what we're going to do today, is talk about their ideas for how to, if we see a reversion back to nationalism, how can we use that as a way to channel these energies in a way to sort of move us towards positive economic growth and in a way to reduce anger.
So I think that brings up a really good segue here, and like their whole focus on like driving, you know, economic growth even higher than what it kind of currently is now. So we've been seeing, I guess, something in economics that we refer to as secular stagnation. Forrest, how would you simply explain to me, like I'm five, how would you explain secular stagnation?
I'm not sure how to explain like real interest rates to a five-year-old. It'd be something like, look, like we live in a world today where real interest rates are really low and inflation is really low, and we kind of don't know why. So Japan has been kind of a case study in this for the past 30 or 40 years. And so Krugman has done a ton of work on like why Japan has had deflation, low levels of growth. And Larry Summers has outlined a kind of a broader vision of like, okay, globally we observe low real interest rates, we observe low levels of inflation, low levels of growth. Like, why? And the kind of this term secular stagnation, and like secular here means like long time period, not like non-religious. So secular mean long-term stagnation, and like it's like a combination of a lack of investment and an increase in savings. And so a lack of investment being due to changes in demographics, which the authors address. You know, you just have fewer working age individuals relative to the whole population, and so you just kind of need less capital per person. And that there's another argument that cost of capital is lower with technology. Just like, you know, a smartphone is incredibly productive and is very cheap. And so just the amount or the spending on capital is lower relative to what it needed to be in the past. And then you combine that with an increase in savings. So you have a bunch of old people that love Roslyn Capital. I've been watching a lot of Fox News recently with my father and stepmom. And then you have trends towards wealth and income inequality, where old people save more, their marginal propensity, or sorry, wealthier people save more, their marginal propensity to save is higher. And then there's just been like an increased level of uncertainty, which is consistent with the themes in the book. So there's an increased demand for safe assets. So people are buying bonds more. And all these things, reductions in investment, increase in savings, all those things push interest rates down. More people want to save, less people want to borrow. And because of that, the equilibrium interest rate just falls. And so what do you see? You just see this world with lower interest rates, low levels of inflation, higher asset prices, as you know, people are both buying more bonds and more riskier assets, and just a general reduction in growth as we see lower productivity gains. And so, you know, that's not going to be a great explanation for a five-year-old, no. But well, that's okay. Those are the factors.
Yeah, no, that's right. Right. So, I mean, overall, the idea of secular stagnation is like, we just have long-term low growth, but now we want to figure out, well, why is that the case? And so there's a lot of people who think they know why. Larry, like you mentioned, Larry Summers being one of them. And so the authors try to outline kind of some of the drivers of what could possibly be creating secular stagnation and what policies we can kind of create to kind of combat that. And so the idea is that we just want to generate more growth, right? Because that's good. That's a good thing for our economy.
I think there's a combination of like more growth and, but not just as measured by GDP per capita.
Yeah, right. No, I think that's true. Yeah.
Right. So it's you know, the authors are going to make particular, they're going to put particular emphasis in this chapter on like climate change and like equitable growth, right? So it's not just measured by the mean GDP per person. It's going to be, you know, we want to think about like how is that distributed across people? Like, we've got to take from Jeff Bezos and give it to the people, and we'll come back to that later, I'm sure.
Comrade Spence wants to make sure that we're redistributing wealth. So,
well, I wasn't the one with the guillotine in front of Jeff Bezos' house in Seattle, but I won't call you out by name, Jason.
Wait, what? I have been quarantining. I do not like that claim.
Just to rein it, I do think that was actually really helpful, both of you guys. Someone who I have no idea what, I did not know what secular stagnation, or they think in the book they called it secular stability on like the other side or something.
Yeah, that's right. They mentioned secular stability when they want to talk about low inflation. They mention secular stagnation when they want to talk about like low levels of growth and kind of like low interest rates being a problem for monetary policy. That actually kind of gives us, Jason, do you want to kind of tie that into their views about like how we should manage the business cycle?
I don't know. I mean, I do. I want to, but it was hard for me. So I said in the intro that I thought this was one of the best chapters, primarily because I thought like it was the most impactful for them giving policies, but not necessarily me agreeing with a lot of the things that they're saying. And, you know, I don't know.
There's a good quote that they mentioned that I think highlights like strong and weak points of their views about, this is my opinion, about like how we should manage business cycles.
I think I know what you're talking about, right? So it's on page 126. So this is at the bottom of the page. So the death of inflation has also permitted much more aggressive countercyclical demand management, something which many reformers seem oblivious to. It is a profound irony that the policies introduced in the 1980s in response to perceived failings of Keynesian economics actually made Keynesian demand management much more possible. And so they go on to say, explain what you mean by that. Eric goes on to talk about, well, we have these facts about globalization, deregulation of product and labor markets, essentially all destroying inflation. And so
I think that's the key point, right?
Yeah, right. Like, no, that's true.
They're saying Keynesian demand management is possible because you don't have to worry about inflation. And well, actually, that is like coupled with like low interest rates. right? Mm-hmm. So when the government wants to borrow and spend money to, you know, if the government wants to accrue debt, run a deficit, spend money on some project to stimulate demand, well, if interest rates are low, then like the policies of the 1980s, the 1990s, the Great Moderation have like made that possible, right? Have made Keynesian economics possible. And that's what they're going to argue, is that like we can use this demand management, countercyclical demand management, if we're in a recession, it's all right. We can just spend our way out of it, right? We can build a bunch of highways and dams and whatever else, right? I mean, we just spend money, write people checks for $2,000, and we'll get out of a recession.
I mean, that sounds a lot like what you're seeing now. At least there are some proponents of this new theory, new take called MMT, right? John, have you heard of that?
I have, yeah. I actually have heard some really interesting, fascinating discussions on MMT, actually. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Intelligence Squared podcast, but they do like, they have like a debate kind of platform. And there's a super fascinating debate between kind of some MMTers and other, I guess you'd call them anti-MMTers.
Eggheads.
But I it's definitely super fascinating.
Well, I mean, that's what Force basically outlined is really like kind of like MMT in to some degree, is that like debt doesn't kind of really matter. We can just spend. And that if we need to pay back our kind of our debts, we just print more money, right? We own our money. We have a monopoly on it. And so we can print as much as we want to pay back our debts.
We should be a little bit careful. I mean, I think the authors are a little bit more nuanced about their take versus the MMT take.
No, I agree.
So where do they agree? I mean, I think the authors and the MMT crowd agree that if you're not at full employment, right, if you have a substantial mm-hmm. amount of the population that is unemployed, what should you do? Get them employed.
Yeah,
spend right. money to get them employed, and don't worry, that won't cause inflation. Okay. But at some point, if you keep kind of pumping money into the system towards employment or towards, you know, building things, the government spending on things, like eventually you are going to generate inflation. Now the MMT crowd says like, that's fine. The sort of the opposite side of that is like, instead of increasing government spending, you increase taxation. And what the authors are saying is like, well, taxation is politically tough. Yeah. So the authors actually, I like the authors kind of sort of discussion of here's what an effective policy needs to be.
No, I agree. I thought they actually did a really good job of not brushing over the idea of political feasibility. And I think it's really important that they began creating policies that they felt like had some sort of like political teeth. But they're trying to address, you know, the things that we're seeing that they're exploring in Angrynomics, right? Through the first, at least, you know, two dialogues, and then kind of how they explain them a little bit within the macro and the micro world in the third and the fourth dialogues. And I think the biggest one is really like inequality, right? That's kind of the biggest challenge that they're trying to tackle here.
Okay. So before we talk about kind of main challenges and what ideal policies look like, let me just make a side note that like the authors kind of keep coming back to this Keynesian idea, or a sort of a straw man of a Keynesian idea, that like all recessions are demand side recessions, right? That like they repeatedly say things like, we know how to get out of recessions, and it's just for the government to spend more money. Like that's a little bit naive on a couple fronts, right? That mm-hmm. that completely ignores like supply side recessions, and that it completely ignores issues of government debt that accumulate with fighting recessions in the demand side countercyclical management way that they mentioned. And to the quote on 126, they say the death of inflation has also permitted much more aggressive countercyclical demand management. Like that's through fiscal policy only, right? this death of inflation has definitely not helped monetary policy, mm-hmm. right? The death of inflation has really hurt monetary policy, because now with interest rates so low, it's much harder for the Federal Reserve or other central banks to be accommodative, right?
I don't buy that.
I do. Completely.
I do not. 100%. I do not at all. No, I mean, we saw it happen in March. This is why I didn't agree with this part at all. In the book, they said, you know, basically Federal Reserve monetary policy is impotent once we reach that zero lower bound. And that is absolutely not the case. The Federal Reserve and Jerome Powell showed that they have tons of ammunition to tackle either demand or, you know, demand side recession pressures, or even supply side recessionary pressures. And they have the ability to kind of also manage capital markets. And I just didn't necessarily agree with that part.
Oh, I'm not sure we're disagreeing about the same thing. I think maybe I misunderstood you. Do we agree that when inflation is low, it makes it more difficult for central bankers to combat recessions?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I believe that when inflation is low, it's harder for central bankers to stimulate aggregate demand, because in a world with 10% inflation, if you take interest rates to a 0% nominal rate, all of a sudden real interest rates are negative 10%. And that's a very accommodative interest rate to be borrowing at. Whereas, you know, if you're in a world with 1.5% inflation or whatever, 1% inflation, it's much harder to be accommodative for a central banker in that environment than in a world of 10% inflation.
I guess I would agree with that, given the, you know, driver of the recession. Right. I mean, we're basically still navigating, you know, demand side pressures from the current COVID recession. And the Federal Reserve was very capable of combating that. And they lowered interest rates all the way to zero.
I think there's some reasonable criticisms of the Federal Reserve during the 2008-2009 recession that they didn't cut interest rates faster. Are fast enough. And in a world where we had slightly more inflation, we would have generated more growth because real interest rates would have been lower. And I mean, look, you can't argue with the fact that all else equal, if you increase inflation, real interest rates are lower. I mean, you can't argue with that. And so if you really believe in this channel, which I think the authors are going to criticize later, where it's like, all right, you stick a hose in your house and you turn on the water spigot in order to fill up the kettle. Like, look, if you believe in this channel of, okay, we want to like stimulate demand through investment and borrowing, then like all else equal, higher levels of inflation generate higher levels of borrowing. Now, like, there's lots of caveats that need to be made to that statement.
That's fair. I mean, it's fair. I mean, I guess I don't disagree per se, but I think it really just depends. Like, if the Federal Reserve unraveled the same or put up the same backstops they did now and during COVID that when 2008 happened, I think like 2008 would have been like that recession would have been vastly different.
I think maybe this is going to kind of, I mean, the backdrop for the 2008-2009 recession is going to kind of lead us into this, where it's like the author is going to say, oh, these things are super safe and nothing has ever happened to them. Whereas like in 2007, you could have been like, oh, let's just put all our money in real estate. Like nothing ever ever happens to real estate. Yeah. It's like, don't worry ever. And then bad things happen.
All right. So what is the other kind of challenge that we have too, that they're trying to address here?
Okay. Yeah. So that was a digression. Three main challenges: inequality, which they've been outlining the entire book, difficulties related to monetary policy because of low levels of inflation. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to talk about climate change. And I think the discussion of the three of these challenges was actually pretty confusing. It took me more time than I'd like to admit to like figure out what exactly those three major challenges were. So maybe we should talk about like what a smart policy is.
Yeah, so this will bring us to their ideas about what an ideal policy should look like on page 133. Eric's talking and he says, a smart policy has to have three features. First, it has to make a big difference. Second, it should be simple and explainable. Third, it should cut across traditional political lines such that it garners and keeps support across electoral cycles. If it has those three features, it can allow a new politics that calms the anger. It works, it's sellable, and there's no reason to oppose it. So let's start with our first serious hardware modification, a national wealth fund to tackle inequality.
I like this idea. I actually think it's really smart. I think the only issue you have is like,
what do you like invest in GameStop?
It just happens. I mean, we see this on a much smaller scale, like when a company is added to the S&P 500 and mutual funds that track the S&P 500 have to add the company in, well, it ultimately pushes equity prices higher. And so this is an ongoing discussion with Tesla happening right now. And so if you have all governments creating these national wealth funds, pumping in, you know, tons of capital in equity markets, prices are just going to go through the roof. And I don't know if that's good or bad, but I think they'll just be they'll be much further distorted from what equity prices should be representing.
Let me ask you a question. Right now, I can like borrow money at a relatively low interest rate. I can borrow money, like, I don't know, 3 or 4%. And the returns on GameStop are like, what? I get 100% a day or something like that.
Yeah. So wait, this is, we got to say like, this is January 28th we're recording at 8:50 PM. So the market's not open right now, but aftermarket trading is very active still.
The household analog is like, you know what? I should borrow a ton of money so that I can like invest it in GameStop and make a huge return. And then I can pay back that money and I'll have higher net levels after I pay back that money.
Yeah, kind of. That's not totally far off. I would say not necessarily GameStop, right? And maybe just a little aside, all else equal, is not giving financial advice. We are not financial advisors. But
Blockbuster is up because people think it's BlackBerry.
So like I know. I just can't even. But I mean, if you were to buy a second mortgage, if you were to take a second mortgage out in your house and then just buy a broad exchange traded fund or a mutual fund that tracked the overall S&P 500, that's exactly what they're talking about. That's the household analog, because we expect over 30 years, the S&P 500 to essentially return on average about 10, 11%. I mean, that's over the last 80, 90 years, that's been the average. So I think
nominal.
Nominal. Yeah, it's always nominal. And so in terms of real, you know, you pay that back, you pay back your 3% mortgage. And so in real terms, you know, you're still taking home, you know, 7-8%.
Yeah. I have a couple. I'm not opposed to this, but it's one of these things like, do you really want a nation that's like have, you know, the U.S. has been expanding in terms of their debt to GDP, especially with COVID. I mean, what are we at now? It's more than, it's around 100% of debt to GDP, oh,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. I'm not sure exactly what it is. Now that's like less than Japan, which is like in the 200s.
Mm-hmm.
They're advocating for taking on additional debt, right? You issue a bunch of treasuries,
yeah,
right? You sell off a bunch of debt,
which we can do, right? And, I mean, there's still huge demand for our debt,
right? Kind of. I mean, like,
No, I mean, there's a huge demand for U.S. treasuries.
But there's always a point where, like, look, it's never a debt crisis until it's a debt crisis. Until, like, okay, everyone realizes all of a sudden, it's like, okay, this is, like, now we're worried about the U.S.'s ability to pay off all this debt. And so, like, interest rates are always low until they're not. And, like, there's some tipping point that no one can ever predict to where they're not. So, like, I don't know if you'd want to take out 30% of GDP in debt to buy a bunch of assets just because the return on them is, you know, hopefully higher. And then that also kind of leaves open this idea of, like, what do you want to buy? Jason, do you have, like, opinions on what do you want to buy other than just GameStop?
Well, if Reddit has anything to say, it's going to be AMC,
Reddit,
BlackBerry, right?
American Airlines.
American Airlines. So you can't pick ponies, right? You can't pick your favorites. I think that would be a big issue. So
you have to.
You can't, right? You're just picking broad markets. You're just
that's still picking ponies.
No, I mean, you're picking the top 500 companies.
Picking ponies.
Yeah, do the Russell 3000. I mean,
still picking ponies.
Do the Russell 5000. Then that's all the trade. That's all the public companies.
Look, I mean, you were still choosing winners and losers.
No, right? You're picking literally all companies, all tradable companies.
That
there's no winners. I mean, you're picking all companies.
That is,
I mean,
all tradable companies. Like, you're still pumping money into, like, in some sense, like, this is all secondary market. But
none of those, I mean, like, yeah, exactly. None of those monies or none of those companies are would see any of that capital.
That's not exactly true, right? I mean, there's, like, wealth effects and stuff like that, but
I mean, it wouldn't be an injection into a specific company so that they could go back and invest something, unless they're issuing new shares or, you know, they're facilitating share buybacks and stuff like that. I mean, we could get onto the, you know, finance, you know, nuances and minutiae, but in general, like, it wouldn't, I mean, we're not picking any ponies. We're not betting on any industry. It's something like that would, I mean, conceivably work.
And that brings up my question, and, like, really my issue with maybe all of these is, like, they need it to be bipartisan across the aisle. And even listening to you guys talk, like, the whole you can't pick your pony thing, like, that's a pretty politically charged statement, in my opinion, at least. Do you think that this is something that, whether it works or not, can even be passed?
No.
Can you even see that?
Never be passed. I think conservatives would never allow this.
I think the main reason why conservatives wouldn't pass this is because it's debt financed.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, 100%. Saudi Arabia and Singapore and stuff like that, I mean, they're generating a ton of money through exports. They they convert that money, Norway, convert that money into, you know, they pump that money into national wealth funds. I mean, like, actually, Alaska has something like this. There's the Alaska Permanent Fund, where they take money from Alaska, like the oil resources, and if you're a citizen of Alaska, you get like $2,000 a year. So, like, there are things like this, but, like, usually they're based on, like, commodity flows of income, borrow money at super low interest rates and, like, put our money into GameStop.
I mean, why not just do it with some sort of taxation, right? Like, why not?
Well, I mean, they're going to argue that taxation is never politically feasible, which they're not wrong.
No, I mean, I think you could probably, like, if you don't have to do this for the entire, like, you know, U.S. and their budget, but I mean, the Department of Transportation puts together a fund, right? Because they pass, like, some, like, 5-cent gas tax or something like that. Whether that's, you know, regressive or progressive, we won't debate that. But I can absolutely see something like this happening in a smaller scale at the federal level.
I think the most problematic part about what they describe with the national wealth funds is, like, the dividend that pays from it. So before we get to the data dividend, they talk about a dividend from the national wealth funds where it's like, okay, if you're in the bottom 80%, you're going to get some cut from this national wealth fund. And, like, with things like this, the devil's always in the details. Like you can't just say like, okay, based on your tax returns, you're in the bottom 80%. You're in the top 20%. If you're in the bottom 80%, we're going to give you, they're not even clear about whether it's like a cash payment or whether it's actual like ownership in whatever these assets are.
I mean, would Trump Inc. have gotten a dividend?
Because, yes.
Right? I mean, so you're right. I don't think you could use IRS data to drive this.
That part I think is less feasible. I actually think the National Wealth Fund is more feasible. And one of the reasons I like a universal basic income is because like there is no strict threshold. Like you just give everybody X amount of dollars, right?
Yeah.
And that actually kind of leads us into, they're talking about this data dividend as, well, we're going to pay everybody some amount for their data. We're going to establish property rights. Mm-hmm. That's what they say. And you know, we're going to charge Amazon, stuff like that. Could be through a bidding scheme or whatever. And then everybody's going to get some money for it. And like, actually everybody getting some money for something like a universal basic income is more politically feasible than like a strict threshold, right? That like you have to be on the bottom 80% or something like
that. No, I agree.
Now, what do we think about like, charging Amazon and Facebook and stuff like that to use people's data?
God. I mean, what would basic 101 economics say? That if, you know, in like, if the cost to production goes up,
price goes up.
Right? Like, I don't know how you argue with that or argue against that.
I like that as soon as you're like, we're going to establish property rights, like the closet libertarian in me is like, oh yeah, okay. I like this. I'm on board. But it's like the property rights are already established.
Yeah.
Like when I sign up for Facebook and Amazon, like I know that my data is going to be used. Like I am paying $0 to use Facebook in part because I know that one of the prices is like that I have some property rights over my data. I am relinquishing those property rights to Facebook. You know, and like they're saying, oh, we're going to establish property rights. But like, I don't buy it because they're already established. And so like,
I mean, the other thing too, that, you know, we talk about a lot when we talk about Coase theorem is it's not just the establishment of property rights, but like you need some sort of enforcement of those property rights as well. And I wasn't 100% sure, like, how do you make sure that all companies are complying in the absolute way they're going to? And even if you could, like, what would the cost be, right, to do this?
I agree. I mean, right now, the reason why the price of Google and the price of Facebook are zero to consumers is because of, like, there is some hidden price, which is, like, you are giving up your data. Mm-hmm. And, like, if you charge firms some amount for your data, then, like, now all of a sudden, like, you might have to actually pay that price, right? So you might actually have to pay to use these different platforms. That's one kind of scenario.
I think it's honorable if you ask me, because they want to try and knock out two birds with one stone, because they also bring up like how the tech monopolies are another thing that needs to be tackled, which I'm sure you guys could probably argue against that too.
Well, Jason won't, I will.
Yeah. Well, do you guys want to while we're here?
Yeah. Well,
wait, Forrest, you, the libertarian, are going to argue that monopolies need to be broken up?
No. I'm going to argue that Amazon's not a monopoly and Google's not a monopoly.
Oh, I disagree 100%.
Oh God. I mean, like, Jason.
Well, how is Google not a monopoly?
What
does Google
ever heard
do?
Of Bing?
Where does Google generate revenue?
Through ads.
They literally have, in terms of, if you look at like the number of online advertising dollars that go through Google, I mean, it's something in the realm of like 80% here. And in the EU, it's something like 90-something percent.
I have a question. And the question is something like, all right, think of people that are like generating economic value. Okay. This is kind of coming back to previous conversations.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to answer the question of like, who has generated more economic value for the US, let's say. Is it me or is it Jeff Bezos?
Here we are again.
Personally, Jeff Bezos? Like personally?
Yeah, personally, Jeff Bezos. Yeah, personally.
Or is it the...
No, I'm asking personally.
I don't know, right?
Oh, that's a terrible answer because that's wrong.
How many
that's
how
just many, like that's so completely students, wrong.
How many students have you taught over the year?
How many
of those students are generating income and contributing to the overall economy?
This is a beef of mine. A beef of mine is that we have turned as a disclaimer, I may have been spending too much time with my father and my stepmom watching Fox News. We have turned into a society that at times seems to like we don't admire the people that create the most economic value, and like in worse than that, we don't just not admire them, we like vilify them. Like, how dare Jeff Bezos have billions of dollars and only give a minuscule billions of dollars to charity? It's ridiculous. Like, not only is the man like created billions of dollars of economic value, he's also given back billions of dollars. And this idea that like we should vilify people who are like innovative and entrepreneurial and like want to tax them more, because that's what this is. This data dividend says, let's take the most innovative, like productive part of our economy, and we're going to tax them. Like we need for them to share the wealth more. It's absolutely crazy to me that like this is the mindset of a large portion of the population. That like,
I mean, it wasn't so long ago though that we had marginal tax rates of 70, 80, 90%.
That nobody paid. Nobody paid them. Nobody paid 80% marginal tax rates. Like, there were so many loopholes and ways to get around them. Nobody actually had to pay 70 to 90% marginal tax rates.
I'll have to take your word for that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess what they're trying to tackle.
A more fundamental issue is like, why should they? Why should I have to pay a 90% marginal tax rate if I'm actually generating a lot of value? It's like, look, let's take the people who are most entrepreneurial and innovative, and God, mm-hmm. I'm like channeling my inner Art Laffer, but like I am. Like, why should we take the people that are most innovative and entrepreneurial and like penalize them the most? Like, that's so ass backwards.
So, the whole point of the book is to, you know, address the growing issue, the growing anger issues driven by inequality. And I think like the data dividend is like an interesting way to actually begin approaching that. And, high marginal tax rates are, I think, another way. If your goal is to kind of minimize inequality, I think that's a good way to go, right? If your goal is to, you know, I don't know, make sure that the rich keep all their money, then don't tax them. Right? And then you just continue to get, you know, big inequality gaps.
We're sort of talking past each other at this point. So we should talk about a policy that everyone can agree about, which is should just take money from the sky and drop it on everyone. Like, who could possibly worry about helicopter drops of money? I'm actually all in favor of this next one. It's a very simple idea, which is like, hey, there's not enough inflation to do monetary policy effectively. Why don't we just drop money on everyone and like expand the monetary base? And inflation will increase, right?
Yeah.
As long as like what we're producing, the goods and services remain relatively constant, you put more money in the system, prices go up, and like that's inflation. And that's what you get through helicopter drops. And like you increase consumption in some sort of equitable way. I think it's fantastic.
So this is, I mean, would it, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, and please tell me if I am. Isn't this not like basically universal basic income?
I think it's different because like it may be triggered by a rule.
So okay, a universal, fair, but like the driver of it, but like the actual, you know, once it's instituted and the result, I mean, isn't it virtually the same?
Yeah, but I think instead of like, I think of the idea behind a UBI is where it's like relatively stable. So like, mm-hmm. I have this universal basic income. I don't have to worry about this. It's my right as a citizen to $20,000 worth of resources every year or whatever, something, mm-hmm. some amount. Whereas helicopter drops say something like, look, if inflation doesn't hit target, then you drop money on people. Right. Or if we're in a recession, then you drop money on people. And I mean, this is not different than $600, $1,200, $2,000 stimulus checks, mm-hmm. where it's like, look, you know, you give people money. They use some term in the book about like, we don't want to call it helicopter money. We want to call it something adjustments for direct support for consumption.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, the idea is still the same. It serves the purposes of like generating more equitable distributions of wealth and also encouraging inflation to a healthy level. David Beckham, who Jason and I both like and dislike because Eric Sims likes their podcast more than our podcast. Like he's got a nice episode on helicopter money or helicopter drops that we'll put a link to that I think like kind of outlines the ideas of like, all right, here's some rule you would want to use to where the Treasury and the Fed would have the ability to give direct support for consumption to people if inflation is running too low or if the output gap is too high.
So is it, I just want to make sure that we know who David Beckham is. This is the English Premier League soccer player.
Yeah. And part-time podcaster.
Or is this David Beckworth?
I like Beckham better.
I like to believe that David Beckham is sitting in his mansion with Posh Spice thinking about helicopter drops of
wearing
money.
His blazer and that's reading right. His leather-bound books.
Just throwing money at his sons. Take your money.
If we could get David Beckham on our podcast and get him to trash David Beckworth, that would just be absolutely fantastic.
Well, let's see if we can make it happen.
All right. So we will link to the David Beckworth podcast on Macro Musings about helicopter drops. But I'm in favor. Jason, you?
I actually really am in favor. I mean, whether it be triggered by some sort of like automatic stabilizer or whether we go through some sort of universal basic income, you know, proposal. I do like this idea of helicopter drops. I mean, the problem, but I'm not a conservative. I'm not an MMTer, but I'm not necessarily fiscally conservative. And so for me, it's like, oh yeah, it makes complete sense, especially with the low interest rate environment that we're in right now. But I could see how a lot of, politically this just would not be feasible. Outside of like some, you know, recession.
You know, like Milton Friedman was advocating for this for a long time, like as a, you know, staunch conservative a long time ago. So I don't know. I kind of see hope that like, look, if Friedman can get on board with it and the left can get on board with it, like there's got to be some sort of common ground.
Yeah.
As far as the left, Martin Luther King Jr. advocated for something kind of like a universal basic income.
Well, there we go. Look, we got Uncle Milty, we got MLK Jr., and we got the left with the radical left. It's perfect.
And we got them all else equal boys.
That's right. The all else equal
so
boys.
So close to getting it passed. So, all right. Talk to me about dual interest rates. I have no idea what they're talking about here.
So they mentioned these like TLTROs or TLTROs. So TLTRO is a, what is it?
They said, don't ask.
Okay. So they talk about these like TLTROs, which is these targeted longer term refinancing operations. And the idea is like, you want to spur in a recession, like you want banks to lend out money to the real economy, right? You want banks to lend out money to businesses. Mm-hmm. And like, that's in quotes. So like non-financial businesses and like households to engage in spending. And so that's what these round of TLTROs have been. There's been three rounds, as far as I know, in the EU that the European Central Bank has done. And in the one of the last rounds, one of the issues is like, if you give out loans at really, really low rates, you got to kind of make – there's a problem. So if you're the central bank and you're lending out money to financial institutions, you want to make sure that they're lending it to the real economy and not like just reinvesting it in something else and saving it.
Or yeah, just sitting on it, right?
That's right, or just sitting on it, right? And so right now the ECB and the Fed pay interest on excess reserves. So like if you're a bank, a financial institution, and you park your money at the Fed, you can get some sort of positive nominal interest rate for that. Okay. And that rate, whatever it is going to channel through to savers. So what the idea behind this dual interest rates is, or what the idea is for this dual interest rate is like you have one interest rate for borrowers. So you give banks that want to lend out money to consumers and to lend out to businesses, you give them a really low rate. And like that rate is something like it can be in one of the rounds of these TLTROs was like negative 2%, right? It's a very low interest rate. You're borrowing at negative 2%. And they're going to then pass that on to businesses at like negative 0.5%. Okay. And so like, so if I'm a business, I get a loan for negative 0.5%. That's great. The bank is borrowing at negative 2%. So they make some money on that carry trade. Like they're happy. What you don't want though, is you don't want that bank to like borrow at negative 2% and then put that money into the money they can get on excess reserves. Right, the money they can get on whatever they're parking at the central bank, which might be 1% or 0.5% or whatever it is. And I think in the US right now it's somewhere between 0 and 0.5% nominal. And so these things have to be very targeted. And so they have to say, like, look, you have to meet these conditions. If you do meet these conditions in terms of who you're lending to, we'll give you a super, super favorable lending rate. But the rest of the money that you want to park as excess reserves, we'll still give you a high interest rate. We'll give you 1% or 2% or whatever. That way we're not penalizing savers. So we're benefiting borrowers, we're benefiting savers, and then there's a free lunch. Or at least that's what like they're gonna kind of say. There's free lunch.
So I mean, in principle, this thing, I mean, it seems really interesting because we're still letting banks be the primary discerners of who gets loans, right? It's not incumbent on the central bank to now go do their due diligence and make sure that whoever they're lending to is going to appropriately pay them back. I mean, they just don't have the resources and they just don't have the ability to kind of go through that discernment process, but individual banks do, right? And so I like this idea that we let the bank still facilitate these loans. We just encourage them to do it a little bit more, right? Right.
I'm a little bit worried with a couple things. One is just like, all right, so John, like I'm going to make you a loan. I'm going to give you $1,000 and you have to pay me $980 back next year. Like, do you want that loan?
Probably not. Okay. Just 1 year.
All right. Sorry. I'm going to give you $1,000 and you have to give me $20 next year.
There you go.
That's it.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, yeah. Right. So there is some threshold at which, like, you were like, this is law of demand, right? You lower the price, people want more. And like, one nice thing about kind of prices is that they discipline market behavior. If you go in there, I mean, this is a subsidy. This is not a free lunch. I mean, on page 149, the first full paragraph, they say, by contrast, dual interest rates are win-win. Okay, so stealing a line from The Office, these are not win-win-win. Okay? These are just win-win. They are win-win-lose. Because at the end of the day, these are subsidized loans. I mean, the central bank can't give negative interest rate loans and give positive savings on excess reserves to banks and not somehow cover that gap. And, you know, that leads into a whole nother discussion of like, look, are banks going to be able to borrow at this negative interest rate and park their savings at a positive interest rate and game the system and like just directly steal from taxpayer money without even kind of getting into that? I mean, you're distorting prices to the sense of, there's this idea of moral hazard in economics that if you insure individuals against risk and you encourage behavior through distorting the price mechanism, people will make bad decisions. So like if I offer John, okay, quick John, like I'm going to make you a business opportunity. This is like Shark Tank. I'm going to give you $100,000 and you only have to pay me back $20 next year. What are you going to do with that money?
Probably spend it on blow.
Okay.
Good. I'll edit that.
Good. Okay. So that's going to generate short run economic gains, but they're negative externalities, right? There's negative externalities from like a lot of people that are using cocaine that John sells to.
Yeah. Well, it's to sell. It's not to do.
I mean, like your family's going to be okay. But the externality is that like across the street, like you're going to have a bunch of hyped up like people that like maybe cause some ruckus. Actually, I don't know. Like maybe this leads to like short run productivity gains if everybody's doing more blow.
My favorite way to explain moral hazard is thinking of Lois Lane and Superman, and that Lois Lane, falls out of a window for whatever reason. Superman, attuned to Lois Lane, comes and saves her. And so now Lois Lane, the reporter, continues to take more and more risks, knowing that Superman's going to save her. But what's the externality is that he can't be saving someone else when, you know, she didn't need to take the risks in the first place.
So Lois Lane is just throwing herself out the window.
Doing whatever she wants, right? Because she knows she's going to be saved.
And this was, you know, part of the reason for the financial crisis in 08 and 09 was because the people that were selling these mortgages were completely insured from the risk, mm-hmm. right? I could issue one of these adjustable rate mortgages at a low teaser rate, one of these ninja loans or whatever people call them. And then I could sell it. I could sell it to Freddie or Fannie and, mm-hmm. you know, and then that's off the books. And so my incentives are just to like issue as many mortgages as possible, regardless of whether the people can pay them back or not. Doesn't matter to me. And so when you protect people from that type of risk, right, when I don't have to internalize the risk of the mortgage, like I am more likely to engage in bad behavior. And so when you're talking about giving businesses loans at negative 2% interest rates, like, I'll create a dumb business and get a negative 2% interest rate. I have all sorts of dumb ideas.
I mean, just look at what happened with, you know, the current Fed lending facilities during COVID and how businesses, you know, were – businesses that had no business applying for like paycheck protection money were applying for paycheck protection money. Right. And
I applied.
Of course, I knew you would. The All Else Equal podcast needed the extra money. Microphones are expensive. We blow through a lot of them, apparently. I don't know. Thumbs up on dual interest rates or thumbs down?
Yes. periods of extreme financial distress? No, as a general rule.
Okay, fair. I tend to agree with that. I mean, I tend to agree with that. That's kind of my same principle with helicopter drops too. So,
yeah, that leads us to like the next thing they talk about, which is like the SOM rule. They don't explicitly call it the SOM rule, and like you better be careful because Claudia SOM will get you on Twitter if she you will. Don't. For those people who don't know Claudia SOM, she's like incredibly reasonable on like podcasts and in publications and things like that. But on social media, she'll get after you.
She does not mind. She does not mind speaking her mind.
Yeah. She does not mind speaking her mind. So, but there is this idea of a SOM rule, which is like, if inflation is, sorry, not inflation, if unemployment is higher by 0.5 percentage points relative to the previous average for 12 months, and that unemployment rate is hiked for 3 months relative to the previous average, that is a really good predictor of a recession. And so the quote-unquote SOM rule is that, you know, if that thing triggers, that all of a sudden, instead of having to wait for all the political channels to kind of realize it's a recession and things that kind of move through different political processes, like you just have an automatic stabilizer that's like, oh, if unemployment spiked a little bit higher than it has over the past year, that's right. You just like make payments, right? You you generate fiscal spending in response to that. I'm actually a big fan of this. Is like,
me too.
It's just an automatic stabilizer.
I mean, when we teach, you know, principles of macro, I mean, I remember teaching, I haven't taught in a really long time, but I very much remember teaching like the idea of, you know, how taxation should be an automatic stabilizer to the economy, and that we have these automatic stabilizers built in to kind of manage business cycles. But like, in reality, like it just does, that doesn't happen. Like we just don't have these automatic stabilizers don't really kick in.
It's not exactly fair.
I mean, we have them, but they're not there. They don't really stabilize the economy.
Unemployment insurance payments go up in a recession.
Sure.
Taxation
goes down.
Yeah, taxation goes down, and like different social security net payments go up in response to a recession.
But it's not like enough. Like it doesn't like mitigate a recession.
So in your opinion, like what would the payments look like? What would the best format for the payments look like? So So unemployment spikes. How would you have the fiscal trigger generated?
I don't know. I'm not smart enough.
I like the helicopter drop money. Just give, direct support for consumption.
Just give direct support. Yeah. I mean, but that's also like, just give more, just make unemployment insurance just more, right? Like just make it more. Yeah. So people who are going on unemployment, you just get more money.
But not too much.
That's right.
I mean, that's $900 a week.
Yeah, right. We can't give people $1 million on unemployment.
I have a quick question. I don't know if there is like much data on it, but if we like consider the stimulus checks as like, I don't even know, like a test run of giving, you know, universal basic income, is there any evidence that like the stimulus checks were able to actually stimulate the economy in a way? Because I know they were technically like relief checks. Like they were.
Yeah, they absolutely were relief checks. Yep.
Yeah, I think there's good evidence that they significantly reduced homelessness. There's some stuff, but Leo, like Jim Sullivan has done some stuff with this. We'll put a links to. Now, like I think the relief checks actually worked in terms of providing relief and preventing poverty, but at the same time, like I don't know the extent to which they actually stimulated economic growth, right? Those things don't necessarily have to overlap.
I think this is not a great natural experiment for relief checks, there's just, we'll have an, we just have inherently what we call an identification problem. It's like we have too many variables moving and we can't target which one is kind of the driver of some outcome. And so is the relief checks helping, or is it the moratorium on, you know, evictions? Like which one of these things is working, right? And we'll just never know. I know they're working together, but we don't know which one is more impactful.
What was the impact of the Bush tax cuts? I feel like those were like, so Bush, you know, gave some tax cuts, which essentially ended up being like, you know, certain households got stimulus checks for not a lot of money, mm-hmm. but not negligible. And I think
Mitchell Larson.
Yeah.
He'll tell us.
I feel like the majority of the studies on those have like suggested that the Bush tax cuts didn't have a big impact, where like individuals are spending more to cut down on debt than spending on the real economy. And so if individuals are just paying off debt with these things, like you don't really get, there's no stimulus in mm-hmm. it. But to Jason's point, that still could be like relief, right? You can still get relief without getting stimulus.
So I think we're really thumbs up on kind of automatic stabilizers.
Yeah, I don't know what they mean by independent financial counsels.
Yeah, I don't know that.
That sounds something like you get like some, like the Fed has monetary autonomy. It's like you give like some agency fiscal autonomy.
Yeah, Congress.
yeah, but like some other group,
maybe. Or someone who can do this quicker. I don't
John?
Know.
John,
the Treasury, just maybe give it just to John.
Yeah, give it I'll to do John.
It. Good, you're hired.
Blow for everyone.
Yeah, easy enough. Increase productivity 1,000%.
And then they have like one paragraph. They're like, also windmills.
Yep.
I think your green investment is probably better run through cocaine, right?
yeah, I mean, at least as like a front.
Oh, I mean, like you need to grow coca plants, right? You need to grow greenery in order mm-hmm. to get everyone it, cocaine.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't know this, but coca plants are actually more efficient at dispelling carbon dioxide than most other trees.
There you go.
We're going to have to fact check that.
At least that's what my marketing is going to say.
We're going to fact check that.
What do you guys think about green investment? I mean, I feel like a lot of what I get is very political. I mean, probably along the same lines as like what you guys were talking about earlier about like you can't like – the government can't invest in green energy because you have to invest in companies and we can't be picking ponies and stuff.
Well, I mean, like we saw this at least going back to Obama's administration, where they tried to, in some capacity, provide grants and, you know, funds to businesses investing in solar panels. And, you know, at the time, I think the demand was super low and the cost was still relatively high. And so businesses, you know, were able to collect grants and then they just kind of went under after a few years because they weren't selling anything to anyone. But I think we're at a point right now. It seems strange, like some sort of tipping point, very different than 12 years ago, that the country and kind of supply chains are more prepared to, I think, move forward with some like green revolution. Mm. I don't know.
I guess I agree with that in the sense that despite watching Fox News nonstop for the past few days, I still like think that climate change is a huge problem. I'm in favor of like prices are like our best way to like incentivize market behavior in a sense of like, if you think that like carbon emissions or some type of pollution is generating some sort of cost to everyone else, that's fine. Price it in. Like just like, like impose a carbon tax, like make, like make people internalize the cost, and individual economic agents have the best knowledge on like how they can reduce their their carbon footprint. Now, look, Jason, you might disagree with this, but the idea is that like, look, if you want to spur innovation, efficient innovation, and you want to like get people to actually like reduce their carbon footprint, like just price it in, like price it in, and then like let don't try to like come down from on high and say, oh, we're gonna build a bunch of windmills, and like don't worry, like that's gonna generate a lot of energy. It's like, no, like give people the right incentives to figure out the right way to handle the problem. I'm much more in favor of that type of policy to deal with climate change than I am in favor of the climate change policies that like pick winners, which are like, oh, we're going to give these grants to this because they have great brochures and like it sounds good. Like there's all sorts of failed attempts at increasing green innovation, stuff like that, through like wasteful subsidies and things like that. So give people the right incentives.
I mean, I agree with your last part, but it's hard for me not to think, you know, how incredibly regressive carbon tax would essentially be. And I mean, we know that it's not like me, you, and John and every other person in the United States really contributing to climate change. I mean, it's the 1%, it's huge businesses. And if we were to tax these, you know,
do you think like Jeff Bezos is like running his air conditioner too much? Like why are you pointing out like,
I mean, private planes emit so much more greenhouse gases, right?
Than public planes?
than taking commercial airlines versus trains or driving, right? I mean, if you think of Davos, the you know, international global
summit,
right, which discusses all these, you know, planetary and global problems. I mean, all those people were going there in private planes, right? And like that was brought up, I think, a year or two ago, probably 2 years ago now, by a like Dutch historian, and he was
Make them pay more, and then like you've accomplished your goal, right? If they're generating more emissions, they have to pay more.
Jeff Bezos, that's not regressive. Jeff Bezos cranks up the prices on all of Amazon stuff, right? My Amazon Alexa price goes up a little bit more.
That's okay. That's okay. That's part of the point. No. The price goes up for the things that are emission intensive. That's the point. The point is, like, if you're doing something that generates a lot of emissions and you have to pay a heavy tax, then now all of a sudden your prices go up. And so what happens next is that now consumers shift towards the things that are lower emission intensive.
But I'm not the one taking private planes.
That's the price intent. Like, that is the price mechanism working as it should.
I know. No, fair, right? But I think my point is Jeff Bezos, what he would do instead, right? Because a lot of the products that he sells on Amazon are much more inelastic, that he can crank up the price and people will pay them. And then he basically funds the increase in, you know, tax because.
Why wouldn't he have already done that? Like if your argument is, well, he can crank up the prices way up. Like, well, why hasn't he already done that? If you're so scared of that.
That's a fair point. I don't have an immediate comeback to that.
It's because Amazon's not a monopolist. Amazon actually faces a lot of competition. That's a true statement. And like you can be mad, and Jason, you can go there with your guillotine, you know, outside his house.
I never said that Amazon was a monopoly.
I actually think that, I guess this episode I was thinking maybe this would be the shortest, but I don't know. I think we're maybe on the third hour, somewhere in the first hour. I believe you said that.
All right.
Sorry. So I've been scheming to get you guys to argue. That's my fault.
Well, you won. You told us, you warned us. And I think episode one that you were going to try and pit us against each other. Mm-hmm. You won, John Winston the third.
I always do.
Well, you're not the fourth, like Jason Reed the fourth, but you did win something.
So to bring it up. Do we recommend this book? Do we recommend this book to people? I mean, it would have taken them more time to read the book than listen to us talk about it.
Is that true?
Yes.
I think I read this in like 30 minutes, whereas we've been rambling on for hours. I would recommend it, definitely. Part of me feels like just having information and it kind of demystifies a lot of like, what are people thinking about when they try and fix the economy? What are people thinking about when they are, you know, referring to like all these other types of like Keynesian economics and neoliberalism? I think it demystifies that and maybe helps people be more open to change rather than, you know, they hear carbon tax, they think, you know, the government just wants more money. Or they didn't really mention carbon tax, but just first thing off my head. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for being a book that's somewhat on the left, I think they do a pretty good job of acting like they're not on the left or not being super transparent about it.
They try their best.
I would. Yeah, I don't know if I recommend it or not. I guess it would depend. We have problems with it, but it's been a lot of fun to talk about. Like we've managed to like talk for 8 hours about whatever, about the content. Mm-hmm. Like there's got to be something there that's like driving conversation and things like that. So
I thought it was interesting, right? The first two dialogues kind of dividing up and explaining anger and who's angry and why are people angry and things like that. I thought it was interesting to read it in a concise form instead of just kind of having tangential anecdotal evidence of that. And just seeing it written down kind of solidified things that I had already been thinking about and a lot of people had already been thinking about. You know, I think for a professional economist, I don't know if they would get a lot out of this book. These are things and ideas and topics that they would almost surely encounter day to day, especially any macro economist. And so I'm not sure that they would get a ton. And I think like if I were to, the target audience for something like this would maybe be like an upper level undergraduate student.
Yeah.
Who has like some knowledge of economics, wants to generate some questions, you know, have a dialogue with their instructors. So if you feel like you have some economic knowledge, you have a way to kind of do a little bit of research, you have someone to reach out to maybe discuss these things with, I think this is the book for you.
Let's do one big takeaway. So we're going to put each of you on the spot.
Okay.
So we'll conclude with one big takeaway. John, do you want to start?
I think my biggest and maybe most important takeaway is that I think the elites come off looking pretty good after this, better than they did. It sounds like people are at least trying to think of ideas rather than, you know, just turn it off and turn it on again. They're trying to come up with ways to actually rebuild the economy and make it more equitable.
Yeah. The lifeless and largely self-serving technocratic center.
Yeah, they come up looking a little bit better than they did before.
It turns out we actually are working. Jason?
I think my biggest takeaway is I recognize that there's a huge anger in society. And my biggest takeaway of this book is that we still are clueless, I think, in terms of how to address things like racial inequality, right? Something that the Federal Reserve and, you know, the Congress have kind of pledged in a way to tackle. I just didn't see any kind of discussion of that in this book. And so there's some like really deep seated inequalities that are just that are driving still a lot of anger in this country, and rightfully so.
I think, like, for me, the big takeaway is not kind of something I learned from the book necessarily, but like an idea that they've kind of planted in my head, which is this idea that, like, when people feel insecurity, macro or micro insecurity, they have a tendency to retreat to nationalism. Like, we want the state to, like, figure out how to do this. Mm-hmm. And they talk about this at the end of the book, like, that nationalism can actually be this, like, thing we can channel, not towards, like, pumping resources to the Proud Boys or something like that. We can, like, there may be ways to channel nationalism in, like, productive ways. It can be like an impetus for good as well as, like, what we typically think. You know, when I hear nationalism, I think of, like, populism, and I think of, like, negative things. And so, like, something I'll be thinking about in the future a lot is kind of from this book is, like, all right, how can we kind of think about people's tendencies to move towards nationalism in times of distress as, like, a way to generate positive political and economic change? And I don't have any good answers, and I don't think this book provides any necessarily good answers for how to do that. But, like, that is something that's, like, definitely worth thinking about.
Yeah, I don't want to say too much more, but because I thought you said that really well. But I think it really depends on kind of the impetus for what's driving the movement towards nationalism, right? That it's something that can either unite us or divide us. And I don't know what those events are anymore, right? I mean, apparently right now it's GameStop. I think people buying GameStop is something that, the anger that people, when I look on the Reddit forums, the anger that people have against—
It's amazing.
It really is amazing. And, like, left, right, doesn't matter politically. Like, they're all against big financial institutions right now.
This has turned into, like, another populist event.
It really has.
But now it's like you get the kids eating chicken tenders that are, like, on Reddit and are, like, rebelling against the Wall Street institutions.
That's right.
And it has become an us versus them in the same way that the storming of the Capitol was an us versus them. Like, I mean, the authors are not wrong at all in their sort of putting a finger on, people are pissed off.
Yeah.
And, like, they're not wrong about that at all. And so that will be a defining challenge for us as a nation and as a world kind of going forward.
So that's maybe that's a good place to end it. We'll stop there. I mean, that was great sentiment. John, yeah. I certainly appreciate you taking the time to read this book and for listening to Forrest and I blather on about economics. You were a true sport, and we really, really enjoyed your company.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a total blast. Super. I love learning different things that I didn't know about, and it was a ton of fun listening to you guys argue.
Well, Johnny, the Latino Freddie Mercury, we're going to miss you.
But we'll have him on again at some point, I'm sure.
We'll see.
All right, guys. I guess we should, like, say, if anybody is still listening at this point, God bless you.
Hug your wife, hug your kids.
You know, we really appreciate, people tuning in and things like that. So
that's right. And then we'll be back with a more All Else Equal podcast as the beginning of the semester is right around the corner. I know we have some interesting questions piling up our inbox, and so we'll start tackling those. Hopefully to connect you again with professors at Notre Dame.